I guess the title can be To Be Me is a Very Strong Habit. We're all here for a retreat in which we really want to develop more freedom and happiness and joy. And we're really longing for a better life. And this is the basis of the world of Dharma. It offers us some answers. So we should acknowledge that a core motivation for us is to end suffering. We just acknowledge it, even if we don't have this label suffering. But we just have this urge for more freedom, more joy, more ease, more space in our life. And so dukkha is really a powerful motivation for us. The dukkha is the heavenly messenger, the messengers that came to the Buddha and invited him to inquire into reality. And it's the motivation. And the motivation for each of us might be a bit different. For one, it's loneliness. For another, it's fears. For another, it's pain. And here in the retreat, we'll feel one has tiredness, one has body pain, one has boredom coming up. And we all have conditioned dukkha coming up. For us, everyone, conditioned dukkha, sankhara dukkha, meaning some basic limitations that we experience in our life and in our experience itself. And for many of us, when we lessen that dukkha, it's actually enough. And there's no problem with that. There's absolutely no problem. When we lessen the dukkha, we have more calm, we have more ease, we have more joy, we reduce the pains, whatever they are, psychological or physical. And that's enough, and that's okay. But for many, it's not enough. Or we may find that it's enough up to a certain point, and then when the journey continues, we realize it's not enough. We need to get to the source of dukkha, and not just to lessen the dukkha. And that motivation may grow in us. And I think it's very natural that at the beginning we feel we reduce dukkha, and then after a while we realize, but I need to get really to the bottom of it, of the human situation. And fundamentally, we will come to realize that the whole basis of dukkha, of dissatisfaction, discomfort, pain of life, is in the basic belief that I, that me and the world exist like this. And that I live and I die like this. That's where it all goes there in the end. And in that place, the Buddha Dharma is constantly telling us that the belief that I and the world exist and that I live and I die, the source of all the dukkha is clinging, holding on, craving, and that it is possible to cut through all that, just to cut it. But it's like cutting the illusion that ties us. It's cutting through illusion. It's cutting through the dream. It's waking up. I'm struggling at the moment. I've got a new book that's going to come out quite soon, I hope, in Hebrew. Articles that I wrote, and I'm really struggling for a title. And the title is, for me, the best title. It's Hebrew. It's all Hebrew book. The best title, but nobody agrees with it, is Hitpakhut. To wake up out of the dream. But I know that's not a word that in Stymatsky's they really want to see a book called Hitpakhut in Hebrew. Well, it's kind of abstract somehow. That's what I've been told. I don't know. Other people tell me. I don't know. But it's really what we're talking about. It's waking up out of a dream. It's the spell. We have a spell on us. And it's, when we open that, wake up from the spell, we see the world utterly differently. Like William Blake, his one of the best one-line phrases for that awakened view is from William Blake, who wrote, "It's to see the world in a grain of sand, and heaven in a wild flower. To hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." But it doesn't help to know all that in theory, because if we're talking about the spell that ties us, the illusion that makes dukkha, pain of life, we really have to deal with the source, which is the sense of contraction and conditioning, hatnaya, and the illusion that we build that I exist as a self, that I need to control things, that I need to fix myself, that I need to control the world, and the pressure that we feel to be me, and the pressure that we feel to see the world as a thing, as we see it. There's a pressure there that we kind of keep on the same track. Wake up in the morning, same old me all over again. Wake up in the morning, same old world, over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. Same world, same prime minister, same cup of coffee, great. Same me. Okay, all right. Another one. Odiyom kaze. And in a way, not only the Buddha, but all spiritual teachers say we cannot really be liberate without cutting through the illusion of self, of identification, that I am me, and I am the body, and this is my body, and I'm stuck in it, and I don't want to die. And it really doesn't matter who you go to. The Buddha was quite kind of convinced by the yogis of the time, and many of us go to India, and we're really convinced by the yogis. And the yogis, a very powerful message of liberation. And authentic yogic practice in its to its end can be really, really strong. And this was my first motivation for spirituality, one of the first, was just hanging out with the sadhus in Varanasi in 1975, 1976. I just spent ages just sitting with them. And didn't I use the word hitbasen? Hitbasenet? Yeah, that's the chillums. But very powerful. The one thing that seemed to dominate the yogic path that the Buddha, more than one, but one of the things was that the yogic path was trying to disconnect the self from the body by punishing the body. And this was all the ascetism, the sagfanut, which in the end the Buddha said it doesn't work, because this is another form of conditioning or of craving or of attachment. So he in the end got out of it. But in some way or other, every spiritual path will say, you can't win spiritual freedom if you still are attached to me as the body. I am the body. The body is me. Identification with the body. And there's a Zen phrase said, why is it all so difficult? Because 99% of the problems come from the me, and there isn't one. But Dogen gives us, in this beautiful quote that you will know, gives us a way through this. And he said, the spiritual life is to meet the self. To meet the self is to lose the self. To lose the self is to be enlightened by everything in the universe. So the way to, in a way, start is by meeting the self, not by trying, not by fighting it with the yogic extremism, not by looking for illusion somewhere, not by dreams, not by making more dreams, but actually to see the source of it in selfing itself. And you've heard this from both Sandy and myself already. We need to look directly at this self as it arises. So the first thing, and I'm in a way repeating what Sandhya said the other day, but I just want to repeat it in other words. To understand that selfing happens as we're a child of 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, part of learning the world is withdrawing from the world. So a baby, a newborn baby or a baby in the womb is probably totally with the world. And then learning about the world is the growth of consciousness that is looking at the world in order to understand it, in order to survive. Without this, we will not survive. So it's a mechanism that allows the being to survive, knowing the world and knowing me, and having a kind of boss, mufaked, inside that controls this being. So this is a mechanism that is needed, otherwise we wouldn't survive. We wouldn't be able to cross the road, like I was saying to the group today, because we wouldn't know the difference between us and a car. The car and us would be just one thing, so we'd stand in the road and get run over. No protection. So the boundaries allow this being to survive. Boundaries, in a way, are needed for all beings to survive. And the word in the Pali for this is ahamkara. Ahamkara is making an I. All living beings make a self, make an I. Even if it's minimal. My dog knows boundaries. Where is the food? Where is not the food? Where is the body? What protection? Where is home? Where is not home? So that this ahamkara is an active process of creating selfing in order to survive, and all beings do it. And its selfing is active. It's not a thing, self, here. It's an experience, a process, and a constant construction, which unfortunately we forget that it's an active living thing to keep creating a self, and we believe it. Not only do we believe it, it keeps going on further, 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 further. We fill the whole universe with me, 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 and what is mine. Everything then becomes second to this me. So ahamkara starts as a mechanism for survival, and it ends with an absolute obsession and a craziness. Me, my country, myself, my people, my car, my this, my house. Who's at your house? This is your house. Did you, you know, everything. My car. Is it your car? Did you make it? Did you? You know, it's just, it's a decision. I decide my car. Is it your house? Is it, did you got a piece of paper on tabu? This says me. Okay, your name is there. Who says it's your house? Is your country? Is it your country? Do you own, can you eat your country? I mean, where, it's not even in the planet. There's no countries in the planet. There's no lines there. It's just the planet is turning around and the people say, this is mine and this is mine. This is mine. It goes on, it goes crazy. It just non-stop all our life. We are busy with ahamkara. It has no end. And we believe it to be true. Instead of seeing it as a mechanism for survival, we actually believe it is a thing. I've said this before, and I just because it's such a good example. When I went many years ago to the University of Haifa, I was trying to learn Hebrew. Terrible failure, but I was a good boy, and I went every week to lesson in University of Haifa, and I parked my car there, my old white Subaru. And one day, I came out of the class, and it was stolen, gone. But what was funny was right next to it was another white Subaru, exactly the same, that wasn't stolen. There it was sitting there still. There was two white Subarus. Mine was stolen, but not the other one. And of course, oh, they stole my car. My car is gone. It's stolen. And I thought, wait a minute. If the other guy's car was stolen, same Subaru, same white car, I wouldn't care a damn. The same thing happened, the same action, stealing a white Subaru, and, never mind. I was joking about it also in the group today. My baby starts to cry, oh, quickly, must do something, give whatever's needed. If it was the baby of the neighbor, oh, shut up, I'm trying to work in here. My baby, okay, the neighbor's baby, puh. It's this construction of self and the belief in it has a huge result. It's a huge result. And one of the big results of it, and it is quite a subtle point, is that we die. And we die. And if there's no real belief in self and no real selfing going on, we don't die. I don't expect you to really see that clearly right now, this minute, just because there are words being said. But the Buddha talked endlessly about the deathless, no death. And indeed, a lot of the theoretical basis of practice is Paticca Samuppada, the 12 links of dependent arising, the wheel of life, which is all Buddhist psychology in one teaching. And right in the middle of there is, if we hang on to the way we do, to things, to this, to that, to what I need and what I want and so on, we create a me. And when we create a me, we are born into a me. And when we are born into a me, we die. And if we're not born into a me, we will not die. Our carbon, oxygen, will just go back to where it came from. Sure. The body will disintegrate, but there's no me there to die. When my mother had Alzheimer, in the last 2 or 3 years of her life, she was in, at the beginning she was in a place that we bought for her in Oxford, so that we could be near her. And then she moved in to a home in Oxford to be looked after because she lost all function. She just couldn't function. She was lying for 2 years. Those 2 years, in some way or other, were the best years of her life. There was an amazing, amazing deep peace and quiet in her being. No lines on the face. No sign of pain or discomfort. And there would be, because if there's something that went wrong, she expressed it in her face. Some very slight hints. The room full of light, inner light. I remember going there, the nurses and the doctors, they all had meetings in my mother's little room because they loved it so much to sit there. People would come there and sit there and have cups of tea and talk a little bit quietly next to my mother, the nurses and the staff, because the room was so full of something so peaceful, so light, so, I don't know how to put it, the vibration was there, which was so wonderful. And I know at least, these were the happiest periods of her life. She had no function, so there was no mind there. So I don't recommend it to you all as a way out. And you better not say, otherwise people are going to arrest me. You know, Stephen recommends Alzheimer. But it's just a sort of a reminder that this place of no belief in self is also a place, in a way, beyond birth and death. Birthing and dying. So, we need to see selfing as a process, not as a thing. And it's in the word anatta. Because the word anatta is not no self, which would be another fact called no. It's in non, not selfing. It's in the, what's it, eder ani. It's in the not selfing rather than there is no self. The Buddha never said there is no self. So we look at the self, and what we see is transparency. It's shakuf. The practice of being, of looking at selfing, is to see that it's transparent. Shakuf. It's a fiction that we need, but still a fiction, and we need to see it as a fiction and not as a fact or a belief. I was thinking at lunch today, imagine you go to your restaurant and you order a meal and the waiter comes with a plate of brown ichsa mak, kazeh ichs, horrible bit. And you say, what's this? The waiter would say, well, I'm saving you the need to chew it. I'm giving you what's in your tummy already. I'm just saving you the bother. You don't need to chew it. I'm just giving you what's in the stomach. Yeah. So I'm sorry to the cooks for having thoughts like that at lunch. It reminds me when I was 3 years old, that was in London in 1949. There was a woman who was looking after me for a short time when both my parents had to go to work. And she forced me to eat. I was 3 years old. And when I vomited, she made me eat it. Horrible. And I it was just after the war, people would behave very well. She was just thought that that's what should be done. Kind of. But just think, going back to this image for a moment. There is a huge, huge net of relationships. The sun is warming the oceans. The oceans make water. The water goes onto the land. The land has earth. The earth makes plants. People come and look after the plants. Huge amount of effort. They cut the wheat. They bring it to Israel. They make bread. They sell it. They ship it. They cook it. They sell it. They live from it. People's lives based on it. They are devoted to it. The restaurant opens. It brings you the rolls. You eat the rolls. They go in your stomach. They go out in the shit. They go back into the marechet biyuv. They go back into the water. They join the water again. Nitrogen to nitrogen. Water to water. Back into the sea. Back into the clouds. That's a vast network of relationships. And the only thing in that network of relationships that interests us is 2 minutes when the food arrives. That's it. Like, that's it. So we are so limited in our vision. And that's the problem. That's what we pay. The price we pay for attachment and for, conditioning. And that's what we're talking about here. We are wrapped in a very limited slice of reality, which we call me and my interests, and what I want, what I need, what I look at, what's interesting for me, what I need to know for my survival. And it's really hard to go out of that. It's a very, very strong habit. It's not easy because it's grown up in us since the age of 6 months and maybe before. It's hard for us to see it, to see outside it. Nice little one sentence from Pooh Bear, Pooh Adov, when Pooh was walking and he came to Piglet. Piglet was digging in the garden, and Pooh came up behind him, and Piglet said, "Oh, I knew it was you." And Pooh said, "So did I." Just, you know, I know it's me. And it's hard for us to imagine what life is like any other way. It's hard for us to do that. It's hard for us to go into a restaurant and see the whole picture of this food. Hard for us. We the habit is very strong. Many people, for example, it's almost every time we even mention this issue of selfing, people get a bit concerned because they don't understand how it's possible to be motivated to do things in life without a self that says, "I want to make change." And mostly because we're Dharma people, it's positive things. How can I make change in the world? How can I heal the world? How can I make things better? How can I heal myself and others? How can I make peace? How can I do anything good in the world without a self? Isn't it going to stop all action? But this is a vision like that. Because we don't know what our action would be like if it's based on a vision like this. We actually don't know it. We can't see it. So we assume that if this is gone, I'm going to be shituk, paralyzed. No action. I don't know how to act. I don't know how to get up in the morning because there's no ambition left. The me has the ambition. The me has is holding the drive for living. And we just don't see that there's another form of motivation, of drive, of energy to heal the world, to make change, which comes actually directly from that big vision, not from the small vision of me. The big vision brings, in a way, a much more total, holistic source of motivation. And certainly, I don't see any of the kind of real long-term Dharma practitioners and the Dalai Lama and the Dharma teachers that you all know paralyzed. They're just not. There's just a huge amount of energy there. Just a huge amount of energy. When I was in Amaravati last year, the Buddhist monastery in London, near London, I was talking to someone working with Ajahn Amaro, the abbot of the monastery, about his writing, his books. And I said, "Wow, how does he manage to write a book? He's head running the monastery. He's welcoming all the Thai people because the Thailand people, that's their place of worship and practice as Buddhists. He's doing million meetings. He meets everybody. Everybody in the whole community in the round in the north of London, they all know. He goes everywhere. He goes to Thailand. He sees the king of Thailand. He's maybe the senior Thai monk in the whole of the Western world. Big responsibility for the whole of the Theravada Buddhist community in a way in the whole of the Western world. And all of that. I said, how has he got time to write a book? She said, he's writing 13 books right now. So it's important to see the self not as a thing, but as a response, a tguva, as a lived response, a hamkara, a necessary fiction. And it arises in the morning when we wake up. It's like the operating system in a computer. When you turn on the computer, Windows starts. If Windows doesn't start, you think, what to do? Everything's stuck. And that's what we feel if the operating system doesn't appear in the morning as we expect. Who am I? And as we've said, it gets stronger when we need to defend ourselves, we aren't struggling, we have challenge, then the self is dynamic, because the self is a response to guva. When we have challenge, the self gets stronger. When we have joy, peace, and quiet, and we've done some practice about this too, when we're lying meditation here in the hall, self gets weaker. We don't need it. Still there. Part of our practice is to see this. To see that the self is dynamic. It's an experience that comes and goes like other experiences. It's a response, not a thing. And the self can be gross, and the self can be subtle. Gross, gas, means to give to you. I'm responding. I'm the challenge. Bah, anger. This is gross self, strong self. Subtle self. Adin is just in experience. There is an experiencer. Somebody is behind an experience, knowing the world. In an experience, there is an experiencer. That's very subtle. We can look at it. We can see, in an experience, such as a sound, the sound happens, the knowing of the sound happens, tvisa, and the knower arises at the same time. I hear sound. That's immediate, subtle. It happens as a response to the sound. Gross would be, that sound, the muezzin there, I wish he would shut up, or the plane going overhead, I don't like that sound. Oh, it's a lovely sound, that's the bell. Oh. That's lunch. Oh. That's gross. We do something with it. The self is blown up by it. So we need to slowly, slowly see that if the self is an experience, a response, and not a belief, It arises and passes. It's just what is an appearance. It appears. When we're asleep, we don't have it. It appears and disappears. Like everything else in the world. It appears and disappears. If we look very carefully at anything with a deep mindfulness, anything, it goes to pieces. Doesn't matter what it is we look at. If we look at anything, it goes to pieces. And the reason is there isn't things as they are in the world. Everything is in process, is made of other things. So we look at the food that we get in the restaurant, and we might see the sun and the grains and the work and so on in this food. We might see it. Or we just see a plate of food. Ah, I'm hungry. But if we look carefully at anything, it goes to pieces because the belief that the world is like that and I exist like this is a sankhara, is a belief, is a condition. It has learning in it. If I look at any of you people, it's not that you just go to pieces, disappear, but I can't define really a person exactly. And there's recognition, I recognize faces, but can you really define what is a person? Which part of the person is the person? Is this me? This finger? If you just saw the finger lying here, would you say Stephen? Where is Stephen? Where is Alon? Where are we? What are these things called beings that are sitting here with us, each other? How do we penetrate a deep look? Things tend to go to pieces. They tend to become dynamic. They tend to change all the time. And we're not sure what they are anymore. And that's right view. Right view is, you can say, Riya Nechona or Hashkafa Nechona is the first of the Eightfold Path. It's really the essence of seeing with the eye of Dharma. And if you know, there is the Eightfold Path and the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path is after you have already understood that the selfing is a belief and you're not 100% believing it anymore, then the Eightfold Path becomes the Noble Eightfold Path. Noble, Ne'etzal. It doesn't mean totally all the way, disintegrating self all the way. It's reducing the belief. It's lessening the belief in self. And somehow an understanding that we are making ourselves and the world all the time and everything is dynamic. And that is right view, the dynamic nature of reality. That flow and change, including the self. The stream enterer, which is a category of development in the Dharma, and there's a number of Avnei Derech, milestones, and this is one of them. And a stream enterer is very sought after. I want to become a stream enterer. I'm going to be 20 years in the monastery to be a stream enterer. Stream entering means entering the stream, you know, going into the Zerim, the stream. But one of the major definitions of a stream enterer is reducing belief in the self. Stream enterer is given as quite a high level of development. But it isn't wiping out the self. It's simply reducing the belief in the self. And that's the difference. It's the way of seeing with right view where the self is not so dominant as me believing in it totally. There is experiences. Senses are awake. Things are happening. But the chain of conditions, needs, interests, the chain that cuts the world to small prusa, piece called just what I see right now according to my interest, like I was talking about the restaurant and the food, it's already like here. There's already a bigger space. I just want to read a couple of lines from Nagarjuna about this, about the senses and the self. And Nagarjuna is kind of creates Zen-style puzzles that we cannot solve. And these puzzles help us to undo the beliefs that we have in self and the world. And so one of his poems, I'll read part of it, is called Already. You say Kfar. Am I already here before I see, and I taste, and I feel? But if not, if I'm not already here before I, then how could I see, and taste, and feel? How can I know if I'm already here or not? If I were here without them, means Bli Achushim, without them, they could be there without me. I reveal them. Because of me, they are there. In other words, they reveal me. How can I be here without them? And how can they be here without me? If I, to whom these things belong, senses, chushim, cannot be found, how can they be found? Senses, things, the world. I do not go before them, nor am I with them, nor do I follow them. Let go of I am, let go of I am not. In the course I teach in Tel Aviv this year, one of the classes, the last class, was on relationships. And we were exploring, in the heat of difficulty in relationships, Marechet Yechasim. And there we feel, well, there... Sometimes there's the big challenge. Like, all of this is fine on retreat. But when I go home and have to meet my husband, wife, mother, children, families, etc., or the workplace, the makom avoda, all of that collapse total, all dharma disappear. We were looking inside the relationships, where is no self? Inside relationships. And of course, we found, and we worked on it together, the no self within relationships. And if no self, or should we say non-self, or the self, the dynamic nature of self is its nature, then it's going to be everywhere, including in relationships. And we talk, for example, about how a relationship is a system where, you know, any of you who are psychologists maybe know about systemic therapy, where relationship is a system. And what's really happening is a space between people. And there is where things happen, in the interaction, which is not the self of any of them. So a family creates a kind of a vessel, kli, where there are things going on, and change is happening, and people don't understand how it's happening to them, but things are happening in this space called a family, or called couple, or called workplace, or called retreat. The space, there is no self. It's in this, there's a space, and yet we're all part of it, and we're all not part of it. What's the space between two people? What's the space between us here? We're not talking to each other. But there's an awful lot happening in the space between us. That's no self. And yet we're in relationship. Right now, we're in relationship, all of us together. Who? Everything is in flow and change. And relationship is an important, I'm just finishing with this, because a relationship points to love. And love is the space between all of us. Love is the connection that we have. And the more we allow ourselves to be released from self, the more the love becomes the dominant energy. The more we are closed in self, the more the love is cut. The more we allow the self to be just flowing and easy and soft and light and not dominant, the more the love, which is the space between all of us, between us and the world. You can say shayachut, the sense of being with everything. The more the self is, you know, there, then shayachut, relationship, is reduced. The more we let go of the self, we allow things to be free and dynamic, and we see we're less believing in it, the more we find ourselves related to everything. And that's love. And I'll just finish with the famous sentence from Nisargadatta Maharaj about this. Wisdom taught me that I am nothing. No self, non-self. Love taught me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows. Okay.